be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the attorney for an AWOL soldier from Eugene insists on a full investigation into alleged sexual coercion by the soldiers' commanders in Iraq. The Bush administration has reopened the door to logging in the Calmeopsis wilderness, while activists are seeking an injunction. And the U.S. House of Representatives spent a full session today debating the war in Iraq today on the Hill, with the Senate again rejecting a withdrawal proposal.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,500 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports 42,747 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Other sources indicate the true death toll may be as high as 250,000 dead. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 15th, 2006.
I'm Noah Eaton.
And I'm Marlise Franklin. One snowy January night in central Oregon, over 17 service providers and more than 50 volunteers conducted a 24-hour point-in-time count of the homeless population of Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook counties. This activity, carried out nationwide on the same day, provided a snapshot of central Oregon's homeless, who they are, how many there are, what has caused their homelessness, and what services they are receiving. Results of the 2006 tally find there are at least 1,344 homeless individuals in central Oregon. 617 of those are children under the age of 18. The majority of those counted are in families with children. And out of the 625 homeless households surveyed, 44% reported they are homeless because they can't afford rent. 26% report they are unemployed. While this was by no means a comprehensive count, it provides valuable information to those serving the homeless. It also helps to educate the public about the growing issue of homelessness in the region, as well as helping to direct public policy, planning, and development. Noah?
An attorney for Suzanne Swift, the Oregon soldier who was arrested after refusing to deploy with her army unit in Iraq for a second tour, says the AWOL soldier was coerced into a sexual relationship with her immediate supervisor. Swift is a specialist with the 54th Military Police Company based at Fort Lewis, Washington. She was arrested at her mother's house Sunday night by Eugene police and held at a Lane County jail before being returned to Fort Lewis. Swift's attorney, Larry Hildes, has challenged that three soldiers being prepositioning Swift for sex shortly after she arrived in Iraq for the first time in February 2004. Swift said she ended up having a sexual relationship with her immediate supervisor against her will. Swift remained in Iraq until February 2005. When her unit was redeployed in January 2006, she refused to go and remained in Oregon, citing the harassment as a reason.
Medea Benjamin comes to Portland tomorrow, and Portland Code Pink plans to celebrate with a political action on the Hawthorne Bridge. Benjamin, director of Global Exchange and founder of the Colorful Peace Action Group, gathers with activists tomorrow at 4 p.m. on the west end of the span's eastbound lanes. The theme for signs is Stop the Next War Now or Out of Iraq Now. Benjamin speaks Friday night at the St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Church at 330 Southeast 11th Avenue. Doors open at 6 p.m. The event is hosted by KBOO producer and Portland Alliance editor Dave Mazza. For more information, go to www.codepinkportland.org.
In its latest master plan, Reed College acknowledges the value of the community garden located on its campus. Whether or not the garden can be maintained, however, is uncertain. Supporters are seeking a clearly stated commitment from the college for the garden's continuation. KBOO's Stephanie Potter has more.
I like to see what's growing, and I like to smell the smells because it's so fragrant. But the birds, the music the birds make, it's just, and I'm seeing birds that I don't see at home.
That was Sally Strader, who frequently walks her dog through the community garden at Reed College in southeast Portland. The garden has been there over 30 years, and with some 155 plots, it is the largest of the 30 sites in the city. Reed College contends that it will need the site to build additional dorms, and the issue came before a land use hearing yesterday in downtown Portland. Edward Hershey, director of public affairs at Reed, insisted that the college has supported the philosophy behind community gardening.
Beginning when nobody else had any land, Reed has not only acknowledged but been a partner in that philosophy. But I think it would be a terrible signal to anybody else who might want to do this to say, well, once you do it, you can never undo it if you need your land for some other purpose. In this case, it's a very good purpose. It would put more of our students on campus.
Leslie Pohl Cosbo, Community Gardens Director for Portland Park and Recreation, agrees that the college needs to determine what's in the best interest of the school, but that having a community garden is also in its best interest.
So we've had an agreement with Reed College to have the community garden on the site on an ongoing basis, and we've been trying to work with Reed with an understanding that the garden is important to the faculty, the students, and many alums, as well as to the community, and it establishes that wonderful place where the community and the college can come together doing something very positive for themselves and for those who may not even be involved in gardening but receive the thousands of pounds of fresh produce in the community pantries.
She added that several thousand pounds of fresh organic produce are grown for donation each year from the garden and donated to FISH, an emergency food service. Reed College graduate and gardener Laura Schaefer concurred.
That's an ongoing program. It's called Produce for People, and we have a plot devoted to that, and people also just donate the produce that they grow themselves.
Schaefer said the garden is an important source of food for the gardeners as well.
It's terrible to see it go. It's going to interrupt my flow of food, and when I know there are a lot of other people that depend on it really directly, that live in apartments and don't have the money to go to New Seasons every day.
Back in the garden, George McCall shares her sentiments.
Produce for people, I've contributed to that. I mean, I grow for probably 9 months out of the year to get 6 months worth of groceries that I don't have to buy. But the money it costs to put here in the time is a stress reliever. You know, you can't replace that. There's no money value on that for me.
The fostering of community, neighborhood relations, and educational services were also cited as benefits of the gardening program. Over the phone, Paul Cosbo described the involvement of Cleveland High School students.
Unbeknownst to me, there was a group of high school students from Cleveland that started participating last year just solely in the Produce for People program to work the plot for donation, which was just delightful to hear.
According to Kathy Heisey, who's on the board of the community gardens, there are presently over 300 families on waiting lists to receive a garden plot, many facing waits of 3 years or more.
As Portland grows, the demands on this community garden system have exploded. Lot sizes are shrinking, and residents from all walks of life place an ever-increasing premium on their ability to spend time outdoors in the city.
With only half the gardens on city land, Heisey said the community garden system depends on partnerships with private landowners, such as Reed. Edward Hershey from Reed again said he thinks the garden could continue with Reed as a partner, but it will have to be off-campus.
I think if we decided as a task force that in the long run that's essential. It's not a question of preference. We need the developable land on campus.
He said Reed has enjoyed its relationship with the garden but has other priorities.
The issue is that not that we don't like community gardens or value them. It's not central to Reed's educational mission.
Reed grad and gardener Mac McKinley would like to see the garden included in the Reed vision.
They never state that they adopt that as something that they want to hold as a goal and a part of their vision. And yet it's right there for them. It's like a baby has landed on their doorstep and they sort of kick it out of the way.
Meanwhile, Gregory Frank, the hearings officer for the Land Use Division of the Bureau of Development Services for the City of Portland, will be taking written comments on this issue until June 28th. I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
Lenny Edwards, Jefferson High School's longtime television production teacher, says the Portland Public School District is booting him out of his studio classroom and shrinking his program. Edward charges that the move would end a 25-year history of television production at the school, including newscasts and cablecasting Martin Luther King Jr. Day events. Edwards is a beloved figure at Jefferson, which has been hit harder than any other high school by the No Child Left Behind Act. In 2004, Jefferson High and four other schools received a $5.2 million grant from the U.S. Department of Education to hire teachers and create a magnet arts program at Ockley Green Middle School, the primary recipient of grant funds. Jefferson's interim principal says Edwards must change his program to qualify for funding under the grant.
On June 23rd, as part of an unprecedented worldwide event conceived here in Portland, filmgoers at Cinema 21 will screen Universal Pictures' film Serenity, with the proceeds to benefit Equality Now, which works to end violence and discrimination against women and girls around the world. Yesterday, KBOO News talked with the one True Bix, one of Portland's most notorious bloggers and an organizer of the event.
The film basically follows the story of a girl named River, who herself, in a sense, not directly related to Equality in Hell, but in a sense, the themes are similar, had her life sort of interfered with and taken from her by forces beyond her control, basically, in the government. And the story basically follows this group of people on this ship called Serenity, trying to come to terms with how far they will let those forces push them before they stop and turn around and say no more. Fans of Joss Whedon have long done charity events here there for Equality Now. And, of course, through a lot of his other work, there are themes of sort of, you know, female empowerment, if you will. I mean, going right back to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is what he's best known for. So it was a logical connection to join the fans' desire to see this movie on the big screen again with actually trying to do something good for people other than just ourselves. So holding a charity event for Equality Now made sense. I really want to kind of try to focus on the organization we're raising money for because they're not a large organization that lots of people know about like Amnesty International, although in many ways they're inspired by Amnesty International. And so they're one of those organizations that really, truly does constantly run into money crunches. And because of the work they do around the world, this is the sort of event that I think people can really have an impact because this is one of those organizations that pretty much any amount of money you raise for an organization like this is going to count. People who come to this need to keep in mind that if they come to this, they're part of what is an absolutely unprecedented worldwide charity event because this movie is being screened over the course of the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, and then a couple stragglers on either end, in, you know, more than 40 cities in Australia, Canada, England, New Zealand, the United States. This has never happened before. So if you're willing to support this organization, but you're not sure you want to come to this movie, I mean, you'll love the movie, but if you just want to sort of be part of this thing that's never happened before, this is the thing to do.
That was the one True Bix. Portland Serenity Charity screening next week, Friday, June 23rd at 9 p.m. at Cinema 21, located at 616 Northwest 21st Avenue. Tickets will be available online via PDX Browncoats and in person at Cinema 21. For information, go to www.serenitynow.pdxbrowncoats.org.
Teresa Hibden and Rose Wright kept their jobs this week after surviving a recall election in Willamina, Oregon. Unofficial results show that 59% of voters in this Willamette Valley city decided to keep Baller, 63% backed Hibden, and 55% voted to retain Wright. Willamina resident Paul Delaney spearheaded the recall effort because of two council actions earlier this year, the eviction of the popular library cat Aggie, since reversed, and the dismissal of city recorder Lorelei Wright on a 3-2 vote. Baller's term expires at the end of the year, but the other two terms run through the end of 2008.
Gordon Smith remains Oregon's wealthier U.S. senator, with at least $13 million in assets last year, according to financial disclosure reports released yesterday. Smith, a Republican, could be worth as much as $63 million, according to the reports, which broadly chart Sutter's financial holdings but don't pinpoint their net worth. Smith's totals range from $8 million to $37 million in 2004. The bulk of Smith's assets come from the frozen vegetable processing company he owns. Smith's colleague, Democrat Ron Wyden, reported assets ranging from about $1.5 million to about $6 million. Wyden's numbers are also up from last year, primarily because his top asset, a U.S. Senate credit union money market account, jumped above $1 million. Wyden's totals do not include assets or income from his new wife, Nancy Bass, co-owner of New York Strand Bookstore. U.S. senators earned $162,100 last year, although salaries for leaders were higher.
Oregon officials have issued health advisories for three beaches because of higher than normal levels of fecal bacteria in the ocean this week. Rockaway Beach in Tillamook County, River State Park Beach in Lincoln County, and Ecola Court Beach near Cannon Beach are all under state watch. Health officials recommend that people avoid direct contact with the water at these sites. The pollution can cause gastroenteritis, skin rashes, upper respiratory infections, and other illnesses. Although they discourage water contact, state officials say other recreational activities on the beach pose no health risk.
Environmentalists asked a federal judge yesterday to temporarily block logging in the South Kalmiopsis roadless area. The timber was purchased last week in the first such sale since the Bush administration eased logging restrictions a year ago. KBOO's Rochelle Koivinen has more.
Environmental groups said new studies show the logging would kill young trees and increase the danger of wildfire. Lawyers for the U.S. Forest Service countered that the area is so small that the logging would cause no real harm. Josh Laughlin, director of Cascadia Wildlands Project, says there is no public support for logging of unspoiled roadless areas.
There's absolutely no support for this proposal other than the old growth logging industry, the Bush administration, and the industry's puppets in Congress. Oregonians at large, the American public at large, a lot of Oregon's Democratic congressional delegation, including Representative DeFazio, has come out adamantly opposed to this proposal to log in both the North and the South Kalmiopsis roadless areas.
U.S. Magistrate Owen Panner said he would rule on the request next Wednesday. The Forest Service and the buyer of the timber agreed to delay the logging until then. On Friday, a timber company bought the rights to log 261 acres of standing dead timber that was burned in a 2002 fire in the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. It went for about $300,000.
It went for rock-bottom prices. It was basically a giveaway from the Forest Service to the old-growth logging industry. The public is going to be left with clear cuts and stumps, and the private industry is going to be left with huge profits.
Last week, the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals refused to stop the logging under a different lawsuit. Meanwhile, Governor Kulongoski has pledged to file for a court injunction to stop the logging. I'm Rochelle Koivinen, KBOO News.
Senator Ron Wyden says he will let a major fisheries management bill move forward now that senators have agreed to make West Coast salmon fishermen eligible for disaster assistance. The Oregon Democrat said he would block a bill reauthorizing the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. The act is the main law that controls commercial fishing for the entire nation. Coastal communities in Oregon and California are suffering economically because the commercial salmon season is being severely limited this year. Wyden says he had to make a stand to get the Bush administration to finally offer fishermen some disaster relief.
And now we enter our national news segment of our newscast. The death toll of U.S. troops in Iraq has reached 2,500, and the number of U.S. troops injured has surpassed 18,000. The Pentagon's numbers come on the day that the House of Representatives is debating necessity on the war. Democrats are citing the war's pitfalls while Republicans are defending the initial invasion. Washington editor Leigh Ann Caldwell brings us more from that debate.
Despite new milestones of troop deaths, a series of events have assured that the war in Iraq will continue. The Senate finalized emergency funding that will allot an additional $66 billion to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Republican Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania was the only senator to vote against it. Secondly, officials confirmed a replacement to al-Zarqawi. His name is al-Masri. And finally, the House of Representatives would not allow an amendment to be voted on that would require the president to create and implement a plan to exit Iraq. Instead, the House is debating an amendment that affirms that the U.S. will win the global war on terror, which includes the war in Iraq, and that the Congress will not set an arbitrary deadline for troop withdrawal. The House spent the day in debate. The Republicans focused on the war on terror, which they say is the same as the war in Iraq. House Speaker Dennis Hastert from Illinois.
As we watch some of our fellow citizens leap from burning buildings to their deaths, our fear turned to anger, and then anger to resolute determination. America's response started high above a cornfield in rural Pennsylvania. Brave men and women, armed with nothing more than boiling water and dinner forks and broken bottles, stood up, as Americans always do, when our freedom is in peril, and they struck back.
And Republican Mike Rogers from Michigan.
Iraq is the central front on the war on terror. Despite what you hear, despite the pointing out of problems and a very difficult task, we ought not to be asking politicians here in Washington. We ought to listen to our enemy. Osama bin Laden, quote, "This third world war is raging in Iraq. The whole world is watching this war. It will end in victory and glory, or it will end in misery and humiliation." They have declared war against the United States and all those who seek to find democracy and peaceful solutions.
The Democrats, rather, focused on the war in Iraq, which they say is a different war than the war on terror. Democrat James Clyburn from South Carolina.
In Baghdad, in and around that part of the country, we see a failed policy. That is what is causing the problem in Iraq. We must begin to involve the Iraqi people in the reconstruction of their country. 85% of the country is without electricity. Almost 60% of the country is without drinking water. We're never going to be successful until we tackle these problems, and that is where we're failing, because there's no accountability on the domestic front in Iraq.
Democrat Ike Skelton from Missouri.
Rhetoric does not answer the problem. Only the Iraqis can solve the problem in Iraq. They're fighting with each other, and our troops are caught in between. And I say it's time to redeploy and be ready.
Visions of victory emerged throughout this debate. Again, Republican Representative Rogers.
Every great victory ends with our heads held high and safety and security for the United States. Let's not come home in humiliation. Let's not tell all of those families that their loved ones died in vain, because we have a November time frame and not a time frame for victory.
This war has gone on longer than the Korean War. It's gone on longer than World War I, and it's gone almost as long as the European War. If I believe we're making progress, we can't win this militarily. What I'm saying is to redeploy, to get our troops out of harm's way, is the key. I see no progress at all in this operation. I see the opposite. When I see that you talk about Al-Qaeda being encouraged by what we say, Al-Qaeda's gone from 15,000 to 20,000.
And that was Democrat John Murtha from Pennsylvania. It is very likely that the resolution to win the war on terror will pass. Over in the Senate, meanwhile, Democratic Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts offered a measure that would require a timeline of withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq by year's end. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Senate rejected today a call for the withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from Iraq by year's end as Congress erupted in impassioned election year debate over a conflict that now has claimed the lives of 2,500 American troops. In a tactical maneuver by Republicans which brought the matter to an early vote, the Senate voted 93-6 to shelve a proposal which would have allowed, quote, only forces that are critical to completing the mission of standing up Iraqi security forces, end quote, to remain in the year of 2007. Senator John Kerry and other Democrats formed the minority in the vote. They accused Republicans of political gamesmanship. The renegade lawmakers promised an authentic debate next week. It also emerged today that the Pentagon is known to have distributed a highly unusual debate preparation book filled with ready-made answers for criticism of the war.
The U.S. Senate voted on two amendments to the Defense Appropriations Bill today. Senators rejected an amendment introduced by Republican Pennsylvanian Rick Santorum, which calls for sanctions on Iran and provides financial support to pro-democracy groups there. Approved was an amendment introduced by Joseph Biden that opts for diplomatic means to resolve the nuclear standoff with Iran. FSRN's Anastasia Guinevere reports.
In today's discussions over Iran-related amendments to the Defense Appropriations Bill, senators outlined three possible ways that the United States could deal with the problem: militarily, diplomatically, or by applying sanctions. The solution proposed by Republican Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania suggested the last option, namely imposing comprehensive sanctions that would potentially include Iran and other countries.
Impose additional sanctions, not on Iran, but on other entities that are doing business with Iran, and then try to impose a prohibition on importing into this country nuclear fuel assemblies made outside of this country if they do business with Iran. So companies would have to make a choice whether they want to do business with Iran or whether they want to do business with the United States. Part of the amendment directs the president to cut off foreign assistance to the host country of a company investing more than $20 million in Iran's energy sector. The final component of the legislation deals with what we call pro-democracy. This was really the key to this legislation.
Solution proposed by Senator Santorum was not approved by many in both the Democratic and Republican parties. In particular, Republican Senator Warner from Virginia criticized the consequences of sanctions on the United States' international relations.
The amendment runs counter to our efforts and those of the international community to present Iran with a clear choice regarding their nuclear ambitions. The amendment, if enacted, would shift unified international attention away from Iran's nuclear activities and create a rift between the United States and our closest international partners. Moreover, it would limit our diplomatic flexibility.
Republican Senator McCain of Arizona was unhappy about the source of funding for the pro-democracy programs in Iran.
As the Santorum Amendment took money from the U.S. military operating in Iraq. We don't want to do that. I think it was reasonable and a good one.
The amendment proposed by Democrat Joseph Biden of Delaware ensures that the Department of State attempts to influence Iran through diplomatic means. It supports the incentives that six countries, including France, Germany, China, and Russia, have proposed to Iran in exchange for abandoning its nuclear program. So far, Iran has shown mixed signals in response to this proposition. According to Iran's foreign ministry, parts of the package were, quote, acceptable, but other parts were, quote, ambiguous. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditskaya in Washington, D.C.
A federal judge in Brooklyn ruled yesterday that the government can cause immigration law to detain non-citizens on the basis of religion, race, or national origin, and to hold them indefinitely without explanation. This is the first time a federal judge has addressed the issue of discrimination and the treatment of hundreds of Muslim immigrants who were swept up in the weeks after the 2001 terror attacks and held for months before they were cleared of links to terrorism and deported. His interpretation of immigration law gave the government broad discretion to enforce the law selectively against non-citizens of a particular religion, race, or national origin, as well as enabled them to detain them indefinitely for any unspecified reason after an immigration judge had ordered them removed from the country.
The U.S. has barred journalists and lawyers from the military prison at Guantanamo Bay. A group of visiting reporters was forced off the island today under a directive from the Pentagon. A Pentagon spokesperson said the removal was ordered following complaints from other media outlets who charged they were being denied equal access. But questions are being raised over whether the removals were motivated by the reporters' coverage of the aftermath of Saturday's three-day detainee suicides. Their articles included interviews with the detainees' attorneys, who criticized their clients' treatment. The reporters worked for the Los Angeles Times, the Miami Herald, and the Charlotte Observer. A Pentagon spokesperson said the revoking of the permission permissions came not from Guantanamo commanders, but from the Office of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
Scientists are mystified at the carcass of a young beluga whale found in a river in central Alaska, nearly 1,000 miles from its natural ocean habitat. The first guess is the 8-foot-long whale, which often feeds on fish in estuaries and the mouths of rivers, swam away from the ocean in search of food. Canoeists found the whale Saturday on the Tanana River, about 40 miles southwest of Fairbanks. Sylvia Brunner, a marine mammals researcher at the museum in Fairbanks, identified the decomposing carcass and oversaw its recovery on Wednesday. It could have died in the river last fall and frozen during the winter, Brunner said. On the other hand, the whale could have entered the river this spring, seeking fish heading for the ocean. Quote, when you get a carcass like that, there are a lot of unanswered questions, end quote.
The Bush administration is being accused of undermining an environmental regulation at the request of energy and oil companies. According to the Los Angeles Times, the White House pressured the Environmental Protection Agency to loosen rules that would have forced companies to keep groundwater clean near oil drilling sites and other construction zones. The intervention was made after complaints by energy companies and a direct appeal from a Texas oil executive to White House senior advisor Karl Rove. In 2002, the executive, Ernest Angelo, wrote Rove that proposed regulations were causing many in the oil industry to doubt supporting Republicans, quote, when we wind up with this type of stupidity, unquote. Rove forwarded a letter to top presidential environmental advisors and instructed them to respond. The EPA later modified the rules even after Congress had agreed on a detailed compromise. The new regulations went into effect this week.
Thanks, Noah. The Minuteman Civilian Border Patrol Group has hired a contractor to finish building 10 miles of fence along the Mexican border. Construction on the fence began May 27th when about 150 supporters turned out for the groundbreaking. The number of volunteers then dwindled. As few as 4 people were observed working on the fence recently, said Cecile Loomer of the humanitarian aid group Citizens for Border Solutions. A nearby property owner, Jack Ladd, said he hoped the fence would keep Mexican livestock off his property, but he doubted it would keep people out. He said, we want to make it clear that while we oppose illegal immigration, we weren't necessarily trying to keep Mexicans off the land, he said.
A newly created DNA database created by the California Department of Justice and the Human Rights Center at the UC Berkeley aims to reunite some broken families of El Salvador. Hundreds of children went missing in El Salvador during that country's civil war during the 1980s, some stolen, some voluntarily put up for adoption. The DNA reunification project began in 1994. The database of that collected DNA will be turned over to a missing children's group next month in hopes of reconnecting families that were torn apart long ago. Marlies?
Well, it's 5:32, and now it's Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
In repressive regimes, it's common for the authorities to run closed governments. And it's also common for them to crack down hard on people who dare to try shining a little light on the government's actions. Take China. On May 28th, it was reported that authorities there were prosecuting a newspaper researcher for revealing in a published report that a certain Chinese official was about to resign as chief of the military. The researcher's crime? Divulging state secrets. Thank goodness we don't live in such a repressive state, right? Yet, on this same day, it was also reported that the Bushites were trying to prevent 2 civil liberties groups from challenging the legality of Bush's ongoing program of spying on millions of Americans. In an extraordinary move, the government asked 2 federal judges to block these watchdog groups from exercising their constitutional right to go to court. Why? The Bushites claim that merely defending the legality of their sweeping spy program could divulge state secrets. Then, the next day, it was reported that Bush's lapdog of an attorney general, Alberto See No Evil Gonzalez, was warning journalists that they could be prosecuted just for reporting on big stories like Bush's secret spy program. Gonzalez menacingly declared, there are some statutes on the book which, if you read the language carefully, would seem to indicate that prosecution is a possibility. What would be the charge against reporters? Divulging state secrets. This is Jim Hightower saying, so, let's review. The Bushites secretly run an illegal and unconstitutional spy program against their own people. Then, when it's uncovered by reporters and challenged in court, the Bush-Cheney regime goes after the reporters and challengers, trying to hide its own autocratic act behind the curtain of, quote, state secrets. How different are they from China's repressive regime?
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
And this is Jim Hightower saying, stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear a special presentation, The Great Decider, The Unchecked Rise of Presidential Power. At 7, it's Good Times with Reggae Bob. The weather, tonight, raining tonight and tomorrow in the Willamette Valley, highs near 70. In the Columbia Gorge, cloudy but dry, highs in the mid-70s. You are listening to KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River. Have a look!
The U.S. House of Representatives has again voted to end an administration requirement that Cuba pay in advance for U.S. farm goods. Matt Kay reports from Washington, D.C.
The House late yesterday voted to defy the White House for a second year and end a Treasury Department requirement Cuba pay for U.S. farm goods before they leave U.S. ports. Kansas Republican Jerry Moran.
And as a result of that, it has increased the cost of doing business with Cuba in a significant way. And in fact, we've had a significant reduction, 22% reduction in the sale of agriculture products since the adoption of that rule.
But Moran's amendment to block spending to enforce the rule has again drawn a White House veto threat against the Transportation Treasury HUD bill unless it's removed. The same threat last year killed the amendment then, even though the House and Senate agreed on identical language. In Washington, Matt Kay for Free Speech Radio News.
Public school teachers in Oaxaca, Mexico have rebounded from the brutal crackdown against their protest encampment yesterday, mobilizing today along with various sectors of the Oaxacan population. At least 5,000 people have made their way back to Oaxaca City and are once again rebuilding their tent city. FSRN's Vladimir Flores reports.
Yesterday's deadly attack by state police against thousands of men, women, and children in downtown Oaxaca City hasn't shaken the conviction of the striking public school teachers. If anything, the outpouring of public support and outrage has added strength to their mobilizations. Municipal buildings in cities and towns throughout the state have been occupied in protest of the police actions. Teachers, along with students, housewives, and neighborhood residents, took back the city center of Oaxaca today after a retreat last night. The mobilization was broadcast live on the university radio station.
Today we are no longer alone. Besides the social organizations, students are demonstrating with us. In this very instant, the march in solidarity with the teachers is being accompanied by students from the state university. Also, marching along with the teachers and members of social organizations from the Mixtec region. More than 20 town hall buildings have been occupied throughout the state.
The university's radio station has played a key role in the past 36 hours, as it is the only broadcast media giving a voice to the movement since the police destroyed the teachers' radio station in the raid of the Union Hall yesterday. The station opened up its airways to a flood of callers yesterday morning, and it kept taking calls and in-person testimonies until it signed off last night. This teacher, who did not give her name, went in person to the station to tell the city what she witnessed on Wednesday morning.
It was completely brutal, the eviction that we were victims of. More than anyone, the women, because they grabbed us completely empty-handed. They grabbed us and threw us out with violence. Now we're hearing in the commercial radio stations that it was a peaceful evacuation. But we know that it wasn't like that. And we will come as often as is necessary to this station and then go out into the streets to communicate with the people about the eviction that we suffered.
Information regarding the exact number of dead, injured, and detained has yet to be confirmed. figures range between 3 and 11 dead, but precise information is lacking. Sara Mendez of the Oaxaca Network for Human Rights comments on what is known about the wounded and detained.
Today's edition of Noticias is reporting 28 wounded. We also know that a large number of people were treated in hospitals. There are more than 70 people in the Red Cross alone. As for the detained, as of now, we have a list of 15 people, among them members of Radio Plantón, as well as people from social organizations, teachers, and two members of the executive committee of the local teachers' union.
Mendez goes on to say that yesterday's crackdown goes beyond the labor dispute between the teachers and the government. The teachers are calling on the Oaxacan population in general to participate in a mass mobilization tomorrow afternoon to condemn the deadly attack against the protest encampment and to call for the resignation of Governor Ulises Ruiz Ortiz. Oaxaca, Mexico, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
Ted Lewis is the Human Rights Director for Global Exchange. Lewis has just returned to the U.S. from a pre-elections observation in a trip to Mexico. He spoke with FSRN producer Monica Lopez about the potential effects of recent repressive operations in Mexico on the upcoming presidential elections.
We're talking about the upcoming Mexican elections in light of the recent repressive operations that have taken place in Mexico, in Atenco, and most recently in Oaxaca. Can you talk about what kind of effect actions like these would have just prior to a major presidential election?
Well, you know, it's hard to predict how the effect of this, what effect this will have on the presidential race. I was in Oaxaca last week and saw the massive presence of the teachers. They had more than 200,000 people in the streets just a few days prior to this attack. The effect of Atenco is one that I think, in terms of presidential politics, has gone two ways. On the one hand, for those on the right and the people supporting the strong hand of the mano firme policies of Felipe Calderón, who's running with the PAN and from the right, this is the kind of thing that they thrive on. It creates a sense of fear and uncertainty among the electorate, and it has split the left in some ways, because López Obrador, who's the center-left candidate, has been reluctant to embrace the protesters at Atenco because they have been connected with the Zapatista Other campaign. And so it's got an effect in the case of Atenco of putting pitting the left against the left, creating a climate of fear. This in general would favor the right. The situation in Oaxaca and the kind of massive repression, I think it's a little soon to call how that might affect things. In the recent presidential debate that took place just a little over a week ago, López Obrador was very clear about police should not be used, the army should not be used to repress the people, that they're supposed to be there to protect the people. And I think that he's spoken out again in that vein since the repression in Oaxaca. The repression in Oaxaca is quite massive, and the resistance of the teachers is not something that's going to go away. This is a teachers union that has literally been struggling with the state government of Oaxaca, which is still in the hands of the PRI. And that's important to recognize, that the old ruling party still rules the state of Oaxaca. They still rule the state of Mexico, where the Atenco atrocities took place. So you've got a very mixed bag of political actors here. It's hard to pinpoint who's responsible, other than the governor in Oaxaca. If there's any action from the federal level in this particular crackdown, it's hard to see. There were reports that plane loads of federal troops were going into Oaxaca yesterday, but now there's talk of a truce, and that there's a lot of pressure on the federal government to get involved in creating a space for dialogue. We hope that's what's going to happen, and it seems like the federal government is responding in that way because they realize that if there's a spiraling down of violence in the weeks right prior to the election, it really puts a stain on the Mexican process and in turn puts a stain on the right-wing party that the government is currently ruled by.
In light of your recent trip to Mexico for elections observations, were there any particular hot spots that you have identified that election observers will be keeping an eye on?
There has been a standoff in the town of San Blas Atempa for the last 2 years around an electoral fraud. People in that town are threatening to boycott the elections, as the teachers union had already done last week. In addition, there's ongoing situations that have caused political prisoners over the last decade in Oaxaca in places like San Agustin Los Siches. So certainly Oaxaca, with all of its special conditions, is a hot spot. Certainly the way voting will happen in Chiapas, in San Luis Potosi and other areas are in question, but the state of Oaxaca, I think, is probably the biggest what they call foco rojo of the country right now.
Ted Lewis, thank you very much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Chile has approved a gold mining project in the Andes despite concerns by environmental groups. A report by Chile's Diego Portales University warned the $1.5 million Pascua Lama project could have a devastating impact on water availability and indigenous farmers. But Barrick Gold, the international mining company behind the proposal, says they will adhere to strict rules to avoid environmental damage. A final decision is still due from authorities in Argentina, which borders Chile and shares access to the Andes.
Countries in sub-Saharan Africa are still locked up over the debate on whether the pesticide DDT should be used to control malaria, which is currently one of the largest killers, especially among children in the region. Malaria affects between 300 and 500 million people every year. The World Health Organization estimates that around 2 million people die of the infectious disease every year. In Uganda, a pilot project of spraying DDT has started in one of the districts amid vigorous criticisms by environmentalists and other anti-DDT advocates. As Emmanuel Okella reports from Kampala, Uganda preparations are in final stages to spray DDT across the country.
As newer killers such as HIV and Asian bird flu grab headlines, this Asian parasite continues to reap its tragic harvest. Malaria kills one African child every 30 seconds. It's the biggest child killer in the region. A single bite from a mosquito is all it takes. World Health Organization says Uganda is among many countries in Africa that spend over 40% of their health facility budgets on buying medicine for malaria treatment. Poverty is a deterrent to even the most basic precautionary measures. Mosquito nets are beyond reach of many Ugandans. The nets cost about $6 each, while the average daily income amongst most Ugandans is $1 a day. Even treating malaria costs an average of $5 per patient. Although the use of DDT was banned in the United States in 1973, the insecticide is viewed by many political leaders in Uganda as a viable alternative. Uganda President Yoweri Museveni last week said consultations have been concluded to embark on the indoor spraying of DDT. Money to finance the project has been allocated in the 2006-2007 national budget. The budget will be ready for presentation in Parliament later this week. Dr. Sam Kibende of the Uganda Joint Clinical Research Center says there are no substantial scientific studies so far which prove that DDT is particularly deadly to humans or other primates.
You've got a lot of iron in your blood, and actually it's very good for you. Without it, you would die. Is that a problem? No. The presence of DDT in your blood should not be a problem. Actually, some researchers have shown that it can be very good for you. So it's not toxic. DDT has never killed anybody, ever. Actually, these drugs that we are peddling around, giving to people, kill more people than DDT has ever done. Let me give you an example of aspirin. Aspirin kills the biggest number of children in America today, but it cannot be banned because its efficacy, its usefulness outweighs its risks.
Professor Gabriel Bimenya is another researcher from Uganda's Makerere University Medical School. He says some agents in the Western world are fighting DDT usage for particular interests. He argues that the opponents of DDT usage are protecting the established market for malaria drugs.
They have got vested interests in malaria, because some of these countries produce the antimalarials we continue consuming. Some of these countries produce tools to investigate malaria, like microscopes, like dyes we use to investigate malaria, etc., etc. And others are malicious about population control.
But those championing the anti-DDT campaign insist that the insecticide is toxic, and that's why it was globally banned about 40 years ago. Ken Luchamuzi, the vice president of Globe International, an environmental lobbyist group, says they are planning protests to re-campaign the proposed spraying of DDT by the Uganda government.
DDT is one of the 21 toxins globally classified as persistent organic pollutants. Therefore, it is toxic in nature. It is a carcinogen. It can cause liver cancer. It can cause blindness. It can cause infertility. It can even damage the brains. And on top of that, I can challenge anybody in Uganda. Nobody has a right to subject toxicity on people without their mandate. DDT is very sophisticated in terms of fumes travel. It has the capacity to travel a distance beyond 3,000 miles. It could even affect people in Malawi or Botswana or Tanzania. Where do you get the moral authority to subject people to that level of toxicity?
Though some of its international partners in the health sector, like United States Agency for International Development, USAID, are still cynical about the project, Uganda says it's vigorously mobilizing funds to start off the spraying. The question, however, remains whether exercise will not be a waste of time and money. There are reports that DDT has not aggressively been pursued in sub-Saharan Africa because of the continuous life cycle of mosquitoes and poor infrastructure. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okela reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Pro-whaling nations are expected to take control of the International Whaling Commission this week, giving them a majority of seats on the panel for the first time since it banned commercial hunting 20 years ago. The expected shift comes after years of lobbying by Japan to get developing nations to join the commission. Environmental groups accuse developing nations of voting with Japan in exchange for aid, a charge Tokyo denies. Delegates from 70 nations will attend the annual meeting starting Friday in the Caribbean islands of St. Kitts. Activists say the meeting will be a fight for, quote, the heart and soul of the commission, end quote. Pro-whaling countries need a 75% majority of those voting to repeal the commercial ban, considered unlikely, but a simple majority will allow them to make significant changes. Iceland, Norway, and Japan have killed 2,500 whales in the past 12 months, more than in any year since a ban took effect in 1986.
Nepal's government and Maoist rebels held a second round of peace talks today. PC Dubey has the details.
After 2 hours of talks in Nepal's Kathmandu Hotel, Maoist and government representatives reached a four-point agreement, including summit talks between their leaders and the formation of a UN-backed truce monitoring team. Some fear that Prime Minister Girija Prasad Koirala's statement yesterday that he favored a ceremonial monarchy would antagonize the Maoists. But today the fear was allayed with Maoist peace dialogue leader Krishna Bahadur Mahara stating that they would prefer to leave the fate of monarchy in the hands of the people during the election for the Constituent Assembly. At the conclusion of today's meeting, the two sides indicated that summit talks between the Prime Minister and the top rebel leader could happen as early as tomorrow. From Kathmandu, I'm PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
At least 61 people have been killed and 45 wounded after their bus hit a mine in northern Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka's military responded by carrying out airstrikes on suspected Tamil Tiger rebel bases. But Tamil Tigers, however, have denied planting the device. Violence has escalated between the rebels and the government forces since early April when peace talks broke down. But Tamil Tigers want autonomy for minority Tamils in the north and east of Sri Lanka.
More than 250,000 people have been displaced by floodwaters in northeast India. The floods have hit an estimated population of 242,000 in Assam state. Another 10,000 people have been affected in the neighboring state of Tripura. Since the beginning of the summer monsoon, 153 people across India have been killed as a result of heavy rains, lightning strikes, and floods.
Cleanup crews in northern China are trying to clean up toxic coal tar accidentally dumped into a river serving a city of 10 million people. On Monday, a truck carrying 60 tons of toxic coal tar fell into the Dasha River in Shaanxi Province. China's Xinhua News Agency said the truck carrying the coal tar was heavily overloaded when it crashed. The government has said there has been at least 76 water pollution accidents in China since last November.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 15th, 2006. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA. In Hood River, we're at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is the lovely Lisa Loving. Wire editors are G.D. West, Denise Davis, and Jessica Rink Perry. Tonight's audio editor is Jessica Perry. Special thanks to reporters Jacob Fenston, Rochelle Koivunen, and Stephanie Potter and Jessica Perry. Our engineer is Brian Averill, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Marlise Franklin.
What a team that is. And I'm Noah Eaton. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30 a.m., hear that Melanie Silverwolf hosts Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Her guest is Malone Rye, the founder of the British Voices in the Wilderness branch and or author of 7-7, Belonged Bombs, Islam, and the Iraq War. At 9, it's a focus on queer pride, beginning with a broadcast of the classic 1989 documentary, Remembering Stonewall. But 1969 Stonewall brought the gay liberation movement in the U.S. At 9:30, we'll hear about the New Man's Wellness Center, which is part of the Cascade Age Project. We'll also hear from a local filmmaker. DJ Puppet will be in to talk about a national drag competition happening in Port Alice, England. And at 10:30, the guest is Ed Bechdel, comic artist of Dykes to Watch Out For, and author of a new graphic memoir called Fun Home. And at 11, it's Marcy Now with Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your community nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored radio station. Thanks for joining us. And oh, and one more thing. Are you an activist who longs for your own voice on the airwaves? KBOO News Department is looking for an activism editor to compile a weekly update on political events and opportunities around the region. Must be willing to learn audio editing. 2-hour time commitment weekly. So what'd you say? Call our top financial wall, Lisa Loving, at 503-231-8032 or extension 203. Again, that's 503-231-8032 or extension 203. Have a lovely evening.
This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 15th of June. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A new report details how susceptible Canada's First Nations are to violence. As Craig McCulloch reports, the statistics again show that when it comes to crime, the plight of Aboriginal Canadians is far worse than the general population.
The report looks at both Aboriginals who are victims of crime and offenders themselves. Like other studies into the social and economic well-being of Canada's First Nations, the results portray a dismal picture. It finds that about 40% of Aboriginal people 15 years of age and older were victimized by crime, 12% higher than Canada's general population. Aboriginals are also twice as likely to be repeat offenders of crime and 3.5 times more likely to be victims of spousal violence. In terms of reported violent crime, those aged between 15 and 34 were 2.5 times higher to be victims than those 35 years of age and older. It found that 60% of violent crime goes unreported by First Nations, about the same as the general population. In terms of homicides, the study finds that while Aboriginal Canadians only make up 3% of the overall population, they were 17% of victims and 23% of the accused. It also finds that the average homicide rate is 7 times higher for First Nations. First Nations were less likely to be charged with first-degree murder, with 20% of accused Aboriginal individuals being charged in comparison to 46% of the general population. The report also finds massive discrepancies in the number of Aboriginal prisoners. In the province of Saskatchewan, 80% of those in provincial jails are Aboriginal, while only 10% of the adult population in the province is of Aboriginal descent. The figures come from a report prepared by the Canadian Centre for Justice Statistics. For Independent Native News, I'm Craig McCulloch.
The Federal Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Review Committee met this month in Juneau, Alaska. The committee reviewed a reburial protocol from Iowa and heard about a potential dispute between the White Mountain Apache and a Chicago museum. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The NAGPRA Review Committee heard about a plan for handling human remains discovered in Iowa that can't be tied to a specific tribal group. NAGPRA staffer Tim McEwen says the majority of Iowa's tribal groups have signed on to the plan.
The committee reviewed that proposal, which is sort of a prospective way of dealing with unidentifiable remains that the state discovers, and recommended that we go along with reliance on their state law, which is not to transfer them to a tribe per se, but is actually to do a reburial on state land.
He says the plan looks toward the future and is not tied to a specific discovery. The NAGPRA panel also heard about a possible dispute over objects from Arizona's White Mountain Apache that are in the collection of the Field Museum of Chicago. McEwen says progress was made during the meeting.
The parties actually began consulting with each other in the midst of the proceedings as they went off into the hallway and kind of worked some things out. And they changed their positions right there before our very eyes. And while they have not accepted this agreement that might be brokered, they're going back to their respective leadership to see if this is okay.
The review committee gave the groups a deadline to agree on the issue. The NAGPRA review panel's Juneau meeting was its 32nd since it was formed in 1992. The next meeting will be in Chicago or Denver. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Officials from the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma say they plan to open a two-year college in Weatherford, Oklahoma. The Cheyenne Arapaho Tribal College will operate under Southwestern Oklahoma State University until it can offer its own accredited courses. Southwestern has supported the vision for the college over the last 3 years by instituting an American Indian Studies program and offering Cheyenne language courses. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
You're listening to KBOO. It's 6:01 p.m. Thank you for tuning in. Proverbial Perspectives is not going to be aired tonight, but they'll be back next month with Celeste Carey. Tonight, instead, we've got A World of Possibilities distributed by WFMT Radio Network, and the program is called The Great Decider, The Unchecked Rise of Presidential Power. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO. Stay tuned.